From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As a business owner, Congressman Bill Huizenga has seen COVID-19 affecting Western Michigan's construction industry.
We have state projects that are being done because they're critical infrastructure. I'm hearing that more and more of the business investment is being sidelined right now as people are trying to figure it out.
Today, Huizenga checks in. Also, in his hometown of Holland, tulip time's coming to a halt.
Stores downtown gained 20% of annual revenue over the 9 days of the festival and to have been closed on top of it for the last 6 weeks.
Events planned online are still going forward. We'll also talk today to musicians hosting a virtual festival.
It's been, for me at least, almost more intimate than some of my live performances out at clubs and bars and such.
Those stories and more just ahead on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. This weekend was supposed to be Holland, Michigan's Tulip Time Festival, a 90-year tradition. But as with so many things, it's been canceled this year. Later in the program, we'll hear about what that means for the community and how you can still get your tulip fix. But first, we're joined by Congressman Bill Huizenga. He represents Holland, as well as Muskegon, Grand Haven, and other towns in the 2nd Congressional District. He's here to talk with us about evolving developments in Washington and elsewhere. Congressman Huizenga, welcome back to Stateside.
I appreciate it, April.
You held a telephone town hall yesterday to talk to your constituents about what's going on in the community. What were you hearing?
Yeah, that actually was the eighth week in a row that we have done that. Lots of frustration. And as you probably well know, people don't always distinguish in their minds the difference between local government, state government, and federal government. So there's plenty of federal directed questions. You know, how is the Paycheck Protection Program working? What is happening with the stimulus checks, the status of that, Social Security issues, those kinds of things come up. But there were a lot of questions about the state of Michigan. When is it going to be opening up? When is that going to be an opportunity for people to go back to work? But also lots of questions and very much a frustration level with the unemployment insurance system not working, not getting in contact with people. Honestly, a lot of frustration also with not being able to reach local government or state government folks. Certainly, they feel like the governor's office isn't reachable. And we've kept our offices open and doing it all virtually. But we've got people answering the phones, and certainly constituents appreciate that.
For what it's worth, I do believe Governor Whitmer's office is open. As to whether people are able to get through right now, that's another matter.
Sure.
You know, while your town hall was going on, some Michiganders, possibly even some of your 2nd District constituents, were at the Capitol yesterday demanding an end to the governor's state of emergency. We saw also a lot of anger. I'm probably putting that mildly. A lot of yelling, not a lot of social distance. What was your take on the anger that we see right now?
Well, you know, certainly those people, whether it was the original Operation Gridlock or whether it was this version, I think it would have been far more effective had people stayed in their cars, maintained social distancing. But I think it's indicative of the frustration level and people just not understanding. And I know the governor has reversed herself on this, but they didn't understand why they could go out in a rowboat and go fishing, but not if they had a trolling motor. You know, West Michigan is very much a small business haven. And it's also based on a lot of construction, a lot of independent contractors that are out there who very much feel that they can go back to work at a very low risk to themselves and employees and anybody else. And they're wanting to open up the economy. Yesterday I had a phone call with the chief economist of S&P Global. And one of the things that she was saying is that the estimates are that within 2 months, 24 to 25% of small businesses could be out of business. And if that grows and increases even to 3 or 4 months, we see that climb get even steeper. And that's going to have a huge impact on our economy.
Michigan has become a flashpoint, not just for coronavirus cases, which now number more than 40,000, but also for the anti-government protests that have been happening in several states. What are you saying to your constituents about their frustration right now?
Well, obviously, I'm telling them they need to reach out as best they can to their state legislators for those issues, to the governor's office. And I wasn't implying that nobody was working at the governor's office. What I'm saying is people don't know how they feel like they can reach out and leave a comment, that they can have their voices heard. That's their frustration that they have. And obviously, what I'm encouraging them to do is be safe, be smart, but also to have their voices heard. That is that's part of our entire process. And I understand that there were and are significant spots around the country and around the state that are having tougher times than others. And as I've said, you know, Marquette County is very different than Macomb County. Ottawa County is different than Oakland County. Wexford County, just south of Traverse City, is different than Wayne County. And it makes sense to me that if we're not going to have the same standards for Montana and Maine and Michigan, then we should maybe also look at the regionalization of that type of thing here in Michigan and try to, again, make sure that we are able to open as much of this economy in a very low-risk, safe way that we possibly can. Because the longer we wait, it's just the harder this climb up the hill is going to be.
We know that when people are in proximity, for example, at work, people do get sick. I mean, we're seeing this all the time in Michigan's hospitals. What is the tipping point for you in terms of knowing whether workplaces are functioning safely? You know, what are the benchmarks that you trust right now?
Well, and obviously everybody's struggling with that. This week I had a call with almost all of the emergency managers from the 2nd District. Were on a call and they invited some of their colleagues from around the state to join. I also had a conference call with all of the heads of the county health departments. And those were the exact questions I was asking them. Not everybody has a consistent answer, other than they know that it needs to be smaller crowds. So in other words, not the same density, not the same sort of gathering points. You know, you mentioned Tulip Time being canceled. That may be appropriate now. What does July look like? What does August look like? I think we're going to have to just be following the trends of where those cases are going to really make those decisions. But I try to leave those up to the healthcare professionals. But I hear very inconsistent things, even within West Michigan, about people's perspectives. And I'm talking about healthcare professionals' perspectives about what that means and how quickly we can get back. Most are just saying, look, the impact hasn't been as significant as what had been predicted. We believe as we are building PPE and we're building the equipment that we need, that we are certainly have the capacity to handle any kind of wave of COVID that may be coming. And they feel prepared and therefore are ready to move on, I think, quicker than some others are.
Your family operates a gravel company.
Yes.
We hear it's likely that construction of several kinds will be reopening maybe at the end of the first week in May. Can you tell us a little bit about what you expect to see in terms of demand?
Well, it's interesting. So here's a perfect example. We have state projects that are being done because they're critical infrastructure. And so I have the stone and the sand and the gravel that is needed for those projects, but I'm not able to make any more of those. And so at some point, we're going to have a supply issue if we can't get open to just start putting material on the ground that has to be mined and it has to be processed. So we're not sure exactly outside of those larger projects what it's going to look like, other than we know that there's a lot of residential projects that are in process right now and in progress. They need to get finished. I'm hearing that more and more of the business investment that is being sidelined right now as people are trying to figure it out. So we're anticipating an impact. We just don't know what exactly it's going to be.
What's the work from home life looking like for you right now?
Conference calls. conference calls, Zoom calls, media interviews. I've got all five of my kids are home. I have three college age kids, a high schooler and an eighth grader. I thought I lived in a reasonably sized house, but I have difficulty sometimes finding a quiet spot, and have found myself in my Ford Explorer at the end of the driveway on occasion to do interviews and things like that, because it's the quietest spot in the house.
You've introduced a bill that would offer a benefit for Michigan's first responders and those throughout the country. Could you tell us a little bit about what you wanted to do for them?
Yes. What we introduced was a bill called the HEROES Act. It's helping emergency responders overcome emergency situations. And what we do with our men and women who are in uniform, who go into combat, actual combat in the military, is that we give them a tax holiday. The federal government doesn't collect their federal income tax for that time that they are in theater. I wanted to take that same concept as a way to reward and incentivize and say thank you to those men and women who are serving our community in a different way right now, who are the first responders. They may be the EMTs and the police and fire folks that are responding to calls. It's not just the nurses and the doctors and those at the hospital that have a medical license. I also want to reward those who are, you know, they may be cleaning the equipment that just got used on a COVID patient. They may be cleaning the rooms that that a COVID patient has been in. I want to say thank you to them as well. And you know, the pharmacists, everybody who's involved in that healthcare side. So it's not as a slight to anybody else who is out there, but as a way of saying to our healthcare workers that are directly dealing with this, we want to say thank you. And here's a small way of doing that by 4 months of you not having to pay your federal income tax.
Bill Huizenga represents Michigan's 2nd District on the west side of the state. Congressman Huizenga, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, April. Appreciate being with you.
Coming up, we hear from some local musicians who are taking their gigs online and hoping that revenues can follow.
I've lived as an artist for a long time, so I've lived on very little. So somehow this time it has been for me a time of having some space.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've talked before on the show about how musicians and DJs all over the world are turning to digital platforms to try to stay connected to the public and fans during the COVID-19 lockdown. Transforming that Facebook Live show into revenue is another matter, though. Some Michigan artists have been hosting a rolling online music festival for the past couple of weeks. We wanted to trace its evolution and how it's been working out. With us today is Chris Good. He's the founder and co-coordinator of the Sing Me Home Festival. He's also a multi-instrumentalist and part of the band Friends with the Weather. Chris, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're also joined by one of the musicians who's performing as part of Sing Me Home, Detroit-based singer-songwriter Audra Kubat. Audra, thanks for being here.
Oh my gosh, April, thank you.
Chris, this time is just devastating in an industry where live music ticket revenue is one of the few durable forms of income for working artists. Maybe this is a dream come true for the deep introverts in the world and people who don't go to clubs for a variety of other reasons. But Chris, weren't you exploring the idea of a virtual music festival before the virus hit?
Actually, we were preparing to announce an in-person festival. We were preparing to launch this new festival. We had been planning and dreaming this idea of bringing a festival to my hometown, actually in Northern Indiana, North Manchester. And we were literally days away from announcing an October in-person festival, right at the early days of March there, where the virus was really taking hold, increasing in intensity. And so like so many, you know, around the country, around the world, our plans were quickly evolving and changing just as we were needing to respond. And we decided to pull that announcement, to pull that initial launch. And the initial days were have to admit, just were really, really depressing, and a lot of grief there, and letting go of this vision and this idea that we had spent so much time investing in. But then out of that kind of emerged this new opportunity, or almost a responsibility, it felt like, to live into the mission of the festival in a new kind of way, to offer both opportunities for artists to share their work in these very challenging times, like you mentioned, as well as offering music to folks who are home and craving those moments of comfort and inspiration more than ever. So the online festival was not at all on our radar. That definitely evolved quickly in just the early weeks of the virus.
What have you learned about when and how people want live music?
Oh, what a fascinating question. I think it's such a staple for so many folks, both in that authentic, meaningful exchange between artist and audience, as well as just the role music can play for people to be a source of healing, a source of inspiration, of connection, of community. And I think in this time where we're separated from each other, that yearning feels even more potent, more poignant. And I think both for artists and audience alike, these online streaming opportunities have, I think, been surprising for so many of us at just how powerful they have been for finding those moments of connection when we're not having that in our days as much as we normally do.
It's totally crazy that at the same time you were learning how to build a music festival, you're also learning so much about online music. Is there anything you've noticed about whether people's need for live streams corresponds with the usual hours of music performance? I mean, club gigs usually get going around 8 or 9 at night. Is that when people want to listen to live streams as well?
Learning so much. Yeah, I think we all are in this steep learning curve of this new reality. And so I think one of the cornerstone kind of principles of the Sing Me Home Festival is trying to be accessible, trying to be an intergenerational festival that engages the youth to the elders. And so we've tried to be creative and provide, you know, different opportunities of different times, different artists for folks to engage with, whether it's a midday family concert or whether it's an evening singer-songwriter slot.
There's everything from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. and later.
Correct. Yep.
I wanted to ask, Audra, how many times have you performed online since the lockdown began?
Oh, my gosh. Definitely a handful of times, probably like maybe 10 or 15 times. A few of those were scheduled. And reactions, you know, to losing gigs that were scheduled. So we sort of went live instead of events that some of us had planned or that I was a part of. And sometimes it's just been like, you know, 11 in the morning and I feel like I want to share. I've even kind of erased them right away, like done some live and then just not shared them out. So like whoever was watching at the time, that's been kind of interesting to do. But there's still something really powerful about doing it and connecting. And what I wanted to sort of share also along, you know, with what Chris is saying and that you're saying is this opportunity to connect almost, it's been for me at least, almost more intimate than some of my live performances out at clubs and bars and such, where like I'm here just alone, like sitting in my room and the person that's listening is either, you know, maybe they're with their family, but they're just kind of there. But then suddenly we're all together when you see sort of the stream of people sending hearts and thumbs and commenting, you're like, there's a interesting feeling about going live. It does feel like there's an anxiety that I get and an excitement. And I really do feel that sort of tickle in my belly, like, oh, I'm doing this. It's been really powerful.
Was there a learning curve to making streamed performances sound good? Chris, could you maybe answer first?
Yeah, absolutely. I think like so many of us who are stretching and learning kind of new platforms and new ways of delivering, you know, what has been just what we do in our trades. I think, some big learning curves talking, you know, and this is such a such a moment for the community to step up and have that kind of shared wisdom. A lot of different artists who have a little bit more of that tech savvy have been very generous in supporting those of the rest of us who have less of that expertise. And so it's been a real collaborative effort, it feels like, where people are there to support each other. And that's definitely something that we're trying to provide.
Audra, what about you? What would you say you've learned about making the performances online sound as the best they can?
Simple is better. If you are, you know, if you play an acoustic instrument and you sing, it seems to have been a little bit easier to just, yeah, go simple, just go through the phone. The phone usually has like sort of the best mic for just that. It gets more complicated if you're, you know, playing, you like a lot of reverb on your voice, or you're like kind of playing an electric instrument. Yeah, simple. It's definitely been a learning curve. I've done sort of the private Facebook page where, you know, me and my friends kind of like practice and watch each other. And I would say what's interesting is there's been a leveling, I think. You know, I've seen people like John Legend go live for his first time and he's like, hey, is this thing on? Like, how do we do this? You know, like there's been this really cool sort of leveling. Like, so there's artists like at all different sort of levels, like struggling with the same thing. And I think that that is kind of an interesting side effect. It's like, I think that it's less important about the sound right now than it is about the intention and about the delivery and about the heart of it.
Yeah. That leveling concept that Audra lifted up is fascinating. And I feel like there's just such a spirit of in this togetherness right now, you know, where I feel like both the artist and the audience is just really engaging in a collaborative spirit, you know, even from our separate homes. And I feel like that's something that is really beautiful about this moment, you know, for everybody digging into just what it means to be a part of a broader community in this time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Chris Good. He's the co-coordinator and founder of the Sing Me Home online music festival. He's also part of the band Friends with the Weather. And we're also speaking with Detroit singer-songwriter Audra Kubat. Audra, in the middle of all this, you have a recent album, The Silver and the Salve, and you recently released a video of a song called Oh Mother.
Oh Mother of Light, Mother of Days, you wait for the words that we promised to say.
The song is about the climate crisis. It's a celebration of this beautiful planet. And then there's also kind of warnings in there and ideas, you know, of ways to take care of her. And yeah, during this time, my partner is a filmmaker, and he'd been working on a project that actually was going to be at the Freep Film Festival. And because it all got shut down, like he had sort of suddenly all this time too, as we all do. And we were like, we should do something. We should finish this video. And we had time. That's when it's been really interesting to have no obligations. It's been a long time, and I feel very privileged to that. You know, I guess I've lived as an artist for a long time, so I've lived on very little. So somehow this time it has been for me a time of having some space.
I'll fight with my songs and my words if I must, to tear down the fences and take down the flags. We'll undraw the lines that divide us in half. Oh, mother of freedom, mother of hope.
I reflected change that I was going through sort of along with her. Like my character, I feel like in the piece becomes a stand-in for her in some way too, of like, you know, using like changing my outside appearance to show like the fierceness that was sort of building inside of me about her, and reflecting her sort of being angry in a way and wanting to kind of shake people off her shoulders.
Oh, mother of oceans, mother of grace, oh, please won't you tell me that it's not too late? Your bodies of water soon won't run clear, and the men on the hill, they just don't seem to care. And I trust in the world you have given to us,
Chris, is there a song that you've been playing more often or just that's been on your mind a bit more lately?
You know, a song that I keep coming back to actually was a song that was written for and with my daughter when she was just a newborn, On the Other Side from Friends with the Weathers album. Kind of speaks to resilience, to encouragement, to finding the lightness within the darkness. The chorus, rock me, roll me, as the days and nights go by together, side by side. It was a song that I wrote literally rocking her to sleep every night when she was struggling to fall asleep. And it has a real upbeat, soulful vibe to it in the midst of what was, you know, excruciating in the moment sometimes, you know, that mantra or that message of just, we're in this together and we're going to make our way through. We don't know what that will look like on the other side, but we're in this. We're in this together, and we'll be here for each other. Like the life that arises from the ashes, ain't no dream. Like the dream that finally breaks free. So rock me, roll me, as the days and hours go by, together side by side, and let me rock you, roll you. We're gonna make it through the night. That for me, you know, that just feels really good to lean into that kind of energy and that kind of message right now. There's just so much uncertainty, so much fear that's just ready to just sink into that, and you could get lost in that. And for me, I just am really looking for those tethers. And this festival has been that for me, those tethers that just keep me engaged with creativity, with resilience, with ways that people are finding this moment as an opportunity to express their core values in a different kind of way.
Audra, you live in Detroit. How have you observed the impact of COVID-19 from where you are?
It's been, I feel there's been a lot of uncertainty for sure. I'm sure everybody's feeling that. I know we've been hit really hard. You know, Detroit's always been like such a friendly place, I feel like. You know, the people that sort of historically have been not celebrated are like on the front lines right now. And I think there's such an important lesson and opportunity right now to be heeded and learned that each person is valuable, you know, that the people that do these really hard jobs and don't get paid well enough for it are keeping Detroit going. They're keeping our country going. When you look at people working at home that are actually being as productive as they are at work, you say, well, this could really cut CO2 emissions, you know, if we had continued. There's just so many great opportunities, I think, that can come from what's happened. And there's obviously a lot of sadness and pain and fear, but I think there's a lot of hope.
Yes. Performances for the festival are free. I noticed that Facebook says it might start allowing artists to charge for accessing live streamed shows. I was curious about what you think of the idea. Is it to the point where there needs to be a little bit more grist to help artists survive and be able to provide this? Or do you think it's better to keep things open access?
I think that's really up to the artists and the community. It's such a unique time of need for so many folks. And I know so many people are stretched. Our festival, actually, we had a $10,000 seed money investment from our partners at the Manchester Church of the Brethren that we decided, you know, that seed money that was set aside to invest in booking talent and starting our launch for this in-person festival in October, we've decided just to invest the entirety of that into providing this online experience in the short term with not knowing what the future holds. And we do have singmehome.org is allowing people to chip in at whatever level they want to continue the programming as we hope to build towards that festival at some point. But we're offering this all for free. That felt good for us. And we had that bit of seed money to make this an experience where we were valuing and giving guarantees to all the artists, as well as providing that for the community. I think a lot of artists are having actually some decent traction, just inviting folks to you know, either a PayPal or Venmo to them directly through their live streams. And I think that's wonderful for artist communities to show up for them in that moment. As far as charging, you know, money, I am always an advocate for people to value music. I think it's just really complicated and tricky right now, as so many people are in need. So we made that decision to offer it for free and give and invite people to invest in the future success and ongoing programming if they chose.
Chris Good is founder and co-coordinator of the Sing Me Home Festival. We've also been speaking with Detroit singer-songwriter Audra Kubat. She's going to be performing as part of the festival Thursday, May 7th. Guys, thank you so much for everything you're doing right now, and good luck with the rest of the fest.
Thank you.
Coming up, another seasonal Michigan tradition comes to a grinding halt because of the new coronavirus.
I'm going to miss being on the streets and asking people where they're from, seeing people be happy and come from all over the nation and even the world to visit Holland and the Tulips is really pretty fascinating and special to be able to talk to those folks.
We're checking in with Tulip Time organizers in Holland in just a minute. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. For more than 90 years, the city of Holland has been celebrating its Dutch heritage and the joys of spring with the annual Tulip Time Festival. It is an ocean of tulips, alongside activities like parades that draw hundreds and thousands of families every year. So what happens when a city like Holland's biggest annual event gets canceled? Gwen Auerda is the executive director of the Holland Tulip Time Festival. Gwen, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It's happy, pleasure to be here.
So Tulip Time was scheduled to start this weekend before the COVID-19 quarantine restrictions hit. Could you tell us about what Holland normally looks like during the first weekend in May?
Oh, my word. There are so many in town. We've got a run that draws 4,000 people, an artisan market. Tulips are blooming, Dutch dance performances, and everybody comes out of their house after a cold winter. And it's really the first start of spring. And it's just a delightful time. Get to see your neighbors and people you haven't seen in a long time.
One of those situations where the population of town exponentially grows?
Absolutely. Over a 9-day period, we estimate around 500,000 people really come out for the activities and festivities. Some of those are locals, but it's hard to count how many people are at a parade.
Right. How much planning does it take to put the festival together every year?
We work at least a year in advance, if not further. So we always are looking for innovative activities, new things to do, fun ways to twist an old tradition, if you will. And so we do spend a good 12 to 18 months planning for each year's festival, which is what's so devastating to have canceled this one 6 weeks before is, or 8 weeks somewhere in there, to just, you know, have known we put all this time and effort into it.
I mean, I don't even know what that looks like. What is the process of unwinding all the work and presumably contracts and arrangements that you make to put things together?
It is a lot of work. It's a lot of phone calls and emails and, you know, trying to get back security deposits. And then all the ticket holders, we have about 8,000 people who buy tickets for a variety of things. It could be a bleacher seat to watch a parade or one of our headlining acts. And so to unwind that and figure out where we stand, we have asked anybody who bought a ticket if they would consider turning their purchase into a donation, as this has been financially devastating to our organization. When you lose all of your income and you've already spent all the time and money planning something. So we've asked people if they would be willing to do that. Some have been really gracious and said absolutely. And so we're thankful for that.
Do you have a sense of what percentage of the pre-sale tickets have been willing to just send that revenue right back to you?
It's a pretty small percent, honestly.
Yeah.
And part of it is we have a large motor coach contingent of folks that visit. And so the motor coach companies can't donate their tickets because they owe that money back to the people that were visiting on their coach. So it's mainly the individuals and the locals who cherish this festival and the traditions that we have. I mean, when your entire income for a year goes away so quickly, it's the fundraising is the only option we have right now to try to, you know, and fill out all the SBA loans and PPP loans from the CARES Act. I mean, that's all I'm spending my time on right now. And the other few staff we have left are trying to unwind things on their own right. But it's It's dicey. It's hard.
What will this mean for the businesses in downtown Holland?
We did in 2018 an economic impact study to see what the economic impact, which is new money brought into the community because of Tulip Time. And we are a catalyst for a lot of that economic engine and economic impact. And in 2018, it was a $48 million impact. So it's huge for our downtown businesses and hotels and stores. And while they all have now been closed for the last 4 to 6 weeks due to the COVID pandemic, it's really also a challenge for them to get back on their feet. Some of these stores downtown have told me they gained 20% of annual revenue over the 9 days of the festival. So that's just huge for them to have missed out on that and to have been closed on top of it for the last 6 weeks.
It's like Christmas season for retailers.
It is. And people say that it's very similar to Christmas from the percentages that go into their coffers.
Well, Gwen, what has this meant for your organization? Have you had to lay anybody off?
Yes, we have had to, unfortunately, do that. We've laid off more than 2/3 of our staff. We've also personally taken some cuts, if you will, in pay just to try to help maintain organization going forward. And we've got a lot of heart into what we do. And it's really difficult to try to unwind this and to not have the festival this year. But we are also hopeful and looking ahead into what we can do for 2021. Likely it'll be scaled back from what we have done in the past, but really an opportunity for us to rethink some things as well.
You know, I was wondering what that looks like for you. I mean, so many of the events around Tulip Time, like you say, parades, it's kind of hard to manage, you know, how many people might show up for something like that. Are there ways that Tulip Time can, you know, start to think and talk about, you know, some form of distance if there's no vaccine by this time next year?
That's a lot of what we're looking at is, you know, our largest venue for entertainment concerts seats 2,000 people. And it's in a church with pews. And I suppose we could try to seat every other person, if you will, and make sure there's distance between people. But we really don't know what the CDC guidelines are going to be by next spring. And we typically, starting in June, would begin to work on contracts for entertainers. We likely won't do that this year. We need to get through the summer and see what those guidelines will be and how we can manage that. The parade route is just packed, people side by side, shoulder to shoulder through the entire route. And that's going to be a little harder to manage when you've got an outdoor public event like that, when you can't control where people stand, walk, or sit. So challenge. I don't know that we have the answers yet, but we surely are brainstorming how to make that work.
Hey, Gwen, I know you probably spend most of the festival dealing with making sure everything goes off on schedule and maybe not enjoying with everybody who's out in the streets, but I was wondering what you're going to miss this year.
I'm going to miss being on the streets and asking people where they're from. When you wear a Dutch costume, which I do many days of the week, or have on my Tulip Time staff gear, clothing, and so forth, people stop and ask questions. Where do I go? How do I get there? And I have to chat with them and say, where are you from? And what brought you to Holland? Besides, how'd you learn about Tulip Time? And when, what brought you here? And that is, I miss that. Yes, I am involved in all the details and making sure everything works, but just seeing people be happy and come from all over the nation and even the world to visit Holland and the tulips is really pretty fascinating and special to be able to talk to those folks.
Gwen, what exactly happens to all the tulips? I mean, are on-site sales at the festival a big thing for Holland's growers?
We don't sell tulips during the festival because the bulbs that the city purchases to be planted in all of the parks come from the Netherlands and they don't get shipped until fall. So we don't actually sell anything during the festival. We have for the last few years after the festival and before the tulips are really, after they're done blooming, but before they're ready to come out of the ground, done a tulip dig where people can come and dig up a bucket worth of tulips and take them home and plant them because we do replant them on an annual basis. A couple of the growers in town do take orders for tulip bulbs be shipped to people in the fall, but that's not something that the festival itself has managed.
So people, if they were driving in the area, not to encourage non-essential trips, but people would still be able to see the crops out in the tulip fields, right?
They can. However, most of our restaurants are doing takeout only. Our hotels, many of them have closed because there's no travel happening. The city restrooms are also closed. So it's a little challenging to come to town and not have the services that we're accustomed to providing for people this year.
Yeah. Have you been in touch with anyone in the Netherlands to find out how their situation is going?
Yes. In fact, I'm a member of the World Tulip Society, and that is a global society of people doing the same type of things we are, festivals and gardens around the world. And we had a call 2 weeks ago to see what everyone is doing. The Netherlands, and most people know of Keukenhof, which is outside Amsterdam, where all the tulips are. They are a gated park, and they closed during this pandemic for the first time ever. And they are doing a lot of virtual tours because you can't get in and see them unless you're in the park. So they are doing virtual things as well as a couple of other festivals that are in Canada and the U.S.
I wonder, do you have any advice for folks who are wanting to, you know, get a little taste of spring and maybe get their Tulip Jones fulfilled at this time of year?
That's a really hard one because with our current stay-home order, we're not really supposed to leave our homes to go do anything. You can get out and walk, but we're always concerned about social distancing and will people take that seriously if you are walking through our city parks. So it's going to be a challenge this year.
I guess that online tour is a pretty good option, right?
It is, definitely. Keukenhof's got some beautiful flowers, so that's a great Facebook page to follow if you are a tulip junkie like I am.
Well, Gwen, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the time. And 2021, come back and come see the tulips. They're going to be beautiful.
Gwen Auerdo is the executive director of the Holland Tulip Time Festival. As much as some readers have plenty of time at home to check out new titles, this is a weird year for book releases. I actually saw a press release the other day from a bookstore entitled All the Book Tours That Didn't Happen in April 2020. Even so, the new titles are coming out. Stateside book critic Kelly Forden has this review of a new one from Michigan author Gail Griffin.
In this communal season of heartache, perhaps a book called Grief's Country does not sound immediately appealing. But this stunning essay collection by former Kalamazoo professor Gail Griffin is one of those rare books that reminds one that while we all might tell each other stories in order to survive, only a select few manage to do it well. This collection of 10 essays and 4 magnificent poems considers the various aspects of traumatic grief, memory, and survival. Within this book, Griffin chronicles her long-term love affair with a man she refers to only as Bob. She and Bob spent much of their 18-year relationship working at different universities, able to come together only for holidays and sabbaticals. Then, on New Year's Eve 2008, after Bob retired, they finally decided to tie the knot. 4 months later, Bob drowned in the Manistee River, outside their cabin on Fife Lake in Kalkaska County, 20 feet outside their cabin door. Bob, who had experienced a couple of unsettling fainting spells, had gone outside to remove the bird feeder. He devised an elaborate pulley and rope so that he could take it down from the trees each evening to stave off the raccoons. On May 8th, he set off to perform the task as usual, and Gail never saw him again. When she went outside to check on him, all she found was a lone slipper on the grass and one at the bottom of the embankment. His body was found down the river an hour and a half later. Griffin has said she considers these essays as mapping sectors of what Mark Doty refers to as grief's country. She quotes Doty, "There are times I feel I'm translating, in my head, from one language to another. I've become a citizen of grief's country, and now I don't easily speak the old tongue I used to know so well." When Griffin embarks on an ill-fated trip to Jamaica to escape her first holiday alone, she writes, "I passed my 10 days in Jamaica doing exactly what I did all summer at home, reading, staring out at the world, and drinking." It doesn't take long for her to realize that she has, quote, veered from escapism to agoraphobia, centripetal to centrifugal energy in a very short space. But they amount to the same thing, running from danger versus cowering from it. Grief is a beast. I must ride where it takes me, she decides. From a writer's perspective, these essays are technically virtuosic. Some are traditional, others mosaic, some lyrical, some analytical. While writing the book, Griffin has noted that she had to learn how to deal with her powerful emotions, and sometimes that involved looking at them head on, and sometimes coming at it slant, as Emily Dickinson would say. As Griffin wrestled with memory, resisted sentimentality, and faced the traumatic memories of her loss head on, she also managed to create a work of art. The book, which took 8 years to write, was never meant to be a book, she's told interviewers, and perhaps that's why she was able to produce such a variegated analysis of the experience. The essays in Grief's Country are stitched together seamlessly with an intimacy and lack of hokey self-help gobbledygook that honors rather than tamps down the necessary practice of grief. She has said that while she was writing, she was attempting to make something shapely out of a complete mess. And in this reader's opinion, she has succeeded.
Kelly Forden, reviewing the new collection of essays, Grief Country, by writer Gail Griffin. Every week, we've been checking in with students from Community in Ann Arbor as they leave us voice messages about how they're doing at home during the shutdown. Here's the latest.
This week has started off really good, and I think it's going to stay that way. I've kind of like adjusted to life in quarantine, I think. Yeah, pretty happy.
Last week, I was feeling pretty positive about quarantine. This week, I felt a lot less motivated. I have also been a lot more sad, I guess. Yeah, like less happy.
Everybody's talking about how they're so bored and they have nothing to do. And I feel like that's how I should feel, but I'm honestly kind of stressed.
Something I have been doing to cope with that is being able to plan the things I can do. So planning what my week will look like, planning what my day will look like, and kind of be prepared for anything that comes along.
I'm worried that, like, what if I'm doing something wrong? You know, what if I shouldn't feel this busy? Why is everybody else having so much time to relax? So I don't know. That's been a little bit stressful.
I'm pretty stressed about college. I'm going to Michigan State, but am I going to Michigan State? Is it going to be online in the fall?
It was just my birthday on Thursday.
My brother's birthday is next week, so we've kind of been thinking about how to celebrate that while stuck in the house.
We're going
to
re-celebrate over in the summer.
A couple of days ago, a bunch of firemen and police officers did a parade in our neighborhood to celebrate one of our neighbor's children's birthday. And we all got out and waved and clapped. And it was so nice to just see how others are helping the community and making so many people happy.
It's weird because, like, I know life isn't going to just go back to normal. Like, going to be, like, very contained. And it's just weird to think about that. Like, are we even going to get back to what it was before? I don't know. I really don't know. I don't think anybody knows. Okay. Bye.
We've been listening to voices of students at Community High School in Ann Arbor. That piece was produced by Michigan Radio's Rachel Ishikawa. Support for Michigan Radio comes from the Michigan Health Endowment Fund and the Children's Foundation. That's Stateside for today. Producers are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber-Davis, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Hang in there this weekend. We'll see you Monday.